Hey, everybody. From KQED's politics team, I'm Scott Schaefer, and this is Political Breakdown.
I'm Marisa Lagos, and this is our very first show.
Our debut, the premiere.
Our maiden voyage, inaugural run in political speak. We are stoked to kick this off. Every week, we're going to be digging into the political headlines and happenings.
And our guest this very first Political Breakdown is Governor Jerry Brown. My impression, he seems to be looking forward to retirement.
I've just produced my first batch of hand-picked organic olive oil. So that's interesting as compared to another 4 years.
Olive oil over the Capitol. As you can hear there, the governor was in a pretty good mood. We spent about 45 minutes with him in his office on Wednesday. He had a bit of a cold, but he still gave us a wide-ranging interview.
He did. We talked about everything from sexual harassment to what it was like to have a dad be the governor.
Why he's so passionate about criminal justice reform and making olive oil on his Colusa ranch.
Yeah, and we talked about figs as well. And we'll get to that conversation with Jerry Brown in just a few minutes. But first, there was quite a commotion at the state capitol today.
And those were supporters of rent control. As you can see, the housing issue in California is not going away. They were there in force to try to push passage of an assembly bill that actually died in committee. It would have repealed a law limiting rent control. It deadlocked at 3-3. One Democrat didn't even bother to vote on it.
And Katie Orr, our Capitol politics and government reporter, joins us now from Sacramento. And Katie, there was a lot going on in Sacramento today, but tell us about that commotion. What was going on?
Yeah, guys, there were hundreds of people who turned out to comment on the rent control bill, both for and against, from what I understand. In fact, it was so packed. When you got off the elevator on the fourth floor of the Capitol, it was like stepping into a sauna. It was so humid. I've never had that experience there before.
A sauna in January, no less.
Yeah.
Kind of gross, actually.
It was pretty gross.
But, you know, Katie, that's funny because we didn't expect that would be the biggest news there today, right? I mean, you were watching another hearing that's sort of been dominating the conversation, that issue, for months.
Right. I was actually there for a hearing on sexual harassment. This was a joint hearing, but primarily done by the Senate. And this was the first hearing the Senate's had on it. It was chaired by Senator Hannabeth Jackson, who said the hearing looked at the law of sexual harassment. But she said her goal overall is to really make sure that sexual harassment stops at the Capitol.
I'm one of the older members here. This is an experience that many of us have lived through, lived with. Our younger colleagues should not have to continue living through this. Time is up.
Time is up is, of course, what we heard at the Golden Globes earlier this weekend from Oprah Winfrey.
So, exactly. Katie, you know, it, just as we heard there, the energy in the building today seemed to be not around sexual harassment, but around the repeal of that rent control restriction. So what does that say about where things are right now that, you know, this issue made a big splash a few weeks ago? Is it kind of simmered down?
Well, you know, that's how things work at the Capitol, right? Something comes, it grabs your attention for a few minutes. Today, the chants from the people in the crowd literally drowned out some of the testimony in the sexual harassment hearing, and I was sitting in the front row. But the people who are a part of the discussion on sexual harassment will tell you that, you know, we might not have as many splashy stories now about different lawmakers, but the policy discussions are actually really starting. We just heard today that there's going to be a bicameral joint committee meeting later in January to talk about real policy changes. I checked in with the people from We Said Enough, the group that sort of got this conversation going here in SAC, and they're going to be talking to lawmakers and legislative leaders in the coming days and suggesting solutions that they would like to see be put in place.
And bicameral, that means both houses of the legislature. Katie,
yeah.
I think we've talked about this a lot. You know, you and I are part of the female part of the Capitol Press Corps. And it does seem like things feel a little different this year up there. Quickly, is there anything that you think has really changed since last year?
Well, I think people are just on edge a little bit more. The legislature is back in session. You hear stories about people maybe not hugging as much as they would have in the past.
Or maybe that's a good thing.
Just keeping themselves in check a little bit more. I think it's kind of a new day, and people are a little bit uncertain about how best to go forward.
Well, thank you, Katie. We really appreciate you joining us and look forward to having you back here. That's Katie Orr, our Sacramento Capital reporter.
Thanks, guys.
All right. Thanks a lot, Katie. Coming up right after the break, our interview with Governor Jerry Brown. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
And we're back. Thanks for joining us on Political Breakdown, our first show. Next up, Governor Jerry Brown. Scott and I got to sit down with the governor in his Capitol office Wednesday, and we had this great conversation.
Governor Brown, thank you so much for inviting us into your office here and for being our first guest on Political Breakdown.
Well, good to be here, and I hope this is not a breakdown, but a breakthrough.
Yeah, there you go.
So, Governor, one of the things as we enter this new year that's been, you know, kind of talked about a lot in the Capitol is the sexual harassment issue. I'm curious, as somebody who's been in and out of Sacramento for years, like, what was your first thought? What went through your mind when you heard about that letter?
Well, I thought that it was reflecting a general sense that women have throughout the country, and giving expression to concerns that assaults and misconduct have not been responded to properly. So this is a focal point, and so Sacramento is not immune. But I think that whatever is happening, it's happening on a wide scale, and I do think that the response and the reaction is going to be to create good procedures, and people will be a lot more sensitive than they've been in the past.
I'm wondering, one thing that struck me about your administration since the beginning is how many strong women you surround yourself with, your wife, your chief of staff, Nancy McFadden. What did you hear from them? And, I mean, do you think that changes how you sort of approach these types of issues?
Well, it's true. This is in a hierarchical office with men in charge and women doing the lesser tasks, the big jobs, starting out in finance and then in the legislative secretary and then in the leadership of Nancy McFadden. It's been very strong women. I think that's served us well. My wife always says that women are better managers because they have better emotional intelligence.
Do you think
yeah. Well, I think that there's a lot to be said for that.
Do you think you take advice better from women than men?
Well, sometimes there's not quite as much competitiveness. Yeah. Males seem to engage in a lot of rivalry and one-upsmanship, and somehow in the world of that I've created here, there's more complementarity than competition.
I wonder, you know, you're obviously an intellectual, you read a lot, you think a lot about the world, but some things you can learn from books, and some things are more experiential. And in this case, you know, if you're not a woman, maybe you have a different experience of what it means, just as if, you know, if you were African-American, you experience racism in a different way. So I'm wondering, did you learn anything from some of the women around you? Did you ask them what their impressions were?
Well, not really. I think this office is functioning fairly well. And we haven't had some of these problems that others have had, and I think that may be because of the women that play such a prominent role. But we're talking about the substance, the issues of the day, and this whole matter of sexual harassment. It's been, hopefully, at least to this point, a more distant problem, and I hope to keep it that way.
Well, you know, obviously your wife, Ann Gus Brown, has been a huge influence on this administration and on your life. The first time you were governor, you were single. Do you think, I don't know, being part of a partnership has changed you and brought different things to the table? We talk a lot, you know, people ask you a lot about the difference between that back then and now. Is that a big part of it?
Oh, yeah, that's a big part. Well, I don't know that I would have moved into the old executive mansion and refurbished it and picked out a lot of the furniture and the fixtures and sure help with that. And
was that her idea?
No, it was not her idea. In fact, it was my idea, and nobody else even thought it was a possibility, including Maria Shriver, other people I spoke with. But because I'd been in the mansion when it was a vibrant place during my father's administration, I knew it was a great home, a great place to welcome guests and officials. So that's why I knew it could be and should be restored. So, yeah, and then help with that. And we're also building this ranch that has been in my family for generations. Ann is a partner in that. Without her, we wouldn't really get it done. So, yeah, it's different. I mean, being going home every night to this sparsely furnished apartment on N Street is a different experience than having someone to talk to and get up in the morning and have lunch with and talk about some of the issues. And in many areas, she's been helpful. High-speed rail and appointments and some of the veto messages, she's able to grapple with complexity very well. And when I write like a State of the State speech, she can often edit and rearrange the paragraphs in a way that's very coherent. So she's a real partner in every sense of the word.
You mentioned growing up in the governor's mansion, and I'm just curious, how do you think that shaped the way you think of the world?
I don't think that house shaped me, other than the fact that I knew it was a good house to be in, very roomy.
But I mean, just being the son of a governor, the governor of California, I could see that it would both be isolating, but also open your eyes to a whole bunch of experiences that you wouldn't have had if your dad wasn't in politics. Is that?
Yeah, it orients you it oriented me specifically from a very early age to think about the larger problems. When I was in high school, I was on the debate team, and we debated whether NATO should be a federation. We debated universal conscription. We debated free trade and reciprocal trade agreements. And to have these debates, you have to read Time and Newsweek and U.S. News and World Report and write out your file cards. So even in high school, all these issues were items of conversation and focus and reflection.
Your dad was district attorney, and I wonder, you know, one of your big legacies as governor, no doubt, is going to be criminal justice reform in a number of ways. And I'm wondering, you know, I know that you felt that part of what you're doing this time as governor is fixing some things that you left behind the first time you were governor, but I'm wondering how you're thinking about criminal justice and reform of individuals has evolved.
Well, there has been some real changes. First of all, there was the change toward mass incarceration, which is a term they use, or just increasing prison building and commitments, things like three strikes, determinate sentencing, minimum sentencing. This all started in the 70s, and I was a part of that by signing the determinate sentencing law. But it went on all over the country. In fact, all over the Western world and beyond, the sentencing for crime became more punitive and longer in duration. So I think it's very important to have a system where there's a second look, and also a system where the prosecutors can't pile on, stack crime 1, 2, 3, and 4. Someone goes on a crime spree for a week, they can know if they're tried on every one of them for just a week's misbehavior, however serious it is, they can get hundreds of years. That was never the case before. It was always a relatively low minimum, maybe 3 years, 5 years, 7 years to life, and then whether they got out depended upon how they performed. Instead, we've gone to lock them up, set the time for the crime, and every year change the time and make it more draconian and longer. That's really a dumb system.
So you talked a lot about the sort of the arc of criminal justice over the last 30, 40 years. But as someone who's been covering this in your two most recent terms, it feels to me like you've had some, I don't know, evolution yourself just in recent years. Is there, has there been a moment or a person or a conversation that changed your mind? You know, I'm thinking about things like Prop 57, but even like the Miranda rights bill for youth that you signed last year that you had vetoed before.
Well, they put a sunset clause on it, and they limited the age. So I thought I'd give it a try.
I guess more broadly, though. Like, is there something that's made you?
But the world is so much different. When Reagan and I were governor, the maximum number of people in prison was 29, 30,000. That was the maximum. And now, without any real increase in the crime rate, or even the actual number of crimes, in many ways they've gone down, the incarceration rate is going up 500%. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. When I didn't know the fact, for example, when Governor Davis was there, the parole board only granted paroles to lifers 1% of the time. So they rejected 99%. But he rejected 99% of the one. So it turned out to be 14 women in 5 years was all that he allowed to be paroled.
I think he
was
sued.
We're not talking about
that.
A pardon or a commutation. We're talking about a governor interfering with the parole board's decision, which should be a relatively rare occurrence. Then under Schwarzenegger, the parole board started increasing their paroles to 5%. In other words, they're rejecting 95% of the time. You can imagine how discouraging that is. And then Arnold approved probably 25% of those. Now, in my term, the parole board's granting 25 to 30%, and I'm increasingly interfering with very few. And nevertheless, the number of people coming into prison for life is growing because the number who are going out on parole are a smaller number, but their recidivism rate is like 1% or 2%. So I think there's a lot we can do that will enhance public safety, will be more human, more decent, and will be more consistent with what human beings are really made out of.
So one of the big sort of looming issues that left over from last year around this is bail reform and something you've promised to work on. How important, how much of a priority is that, and what do you think could be accomplished in 2018?
That I'm not sure. Bail is going to be on the docket for consideration. There are a lot of ideas. I'm going to be careful about it because a lot of these ideas get very expensive. So,
is that your biggest concern, money?
Well, money, you know, it's another one of these things where they come into the state and want the state to give out a lot of commands, but every time we give out a command, then we got to pay for it. So I want to look very carefully at how we make this system better.
When you became governor in 2011, yeah. 70% of the judges in California were white males, and there were many counties that had never had a Latino or Asian American judge, and you've been changing that with your appointments. And you have an appointment on the state Supreme Court, and yeah. It's a big one because it'll be the fourth of seven, and there'll be a majority of your appointees. What are you thinking about? It's been open since, I think, August, so you're taking your time, obviously. What are you thinking about? And I'm wondering also, how do you look back at the last time you were governor with the Rose Byrd Court, and after you left office, three of them were removed by the voters. How do you look back on that now, and how does it influence what you're doing here?
Well, that's a lot of questions you got to ask.
Pick two.
First of all, I want to understand what the court needs. And I've appointed three, but a fourth appointment is a little different because that then becomes a possible majority. So I want to understand what's missing, and from a philosophical point of view, from an experiential point of view, what would be the best candidate. So I am taking my time, but, you know, they do appoint Court of Appeals judges. So the system goes on, and I'll have a candidate very quickly.
And what about how you look back at the Rose Byrd appointment, first female Chief Justice? Does that influence you, or does it? How do you see it now? And do you see it differently than you did?
Well, I see it that the court is a conservative institution. It's not your dynamic change agent. It's the preserver of our constitutional and legal system. So you can't expect to instant or radical changes by the appointment of different judges. So I have more respect for the slow-moving character of what the court is and what the court has to be, because the legislature, in many cases, is someone coined the phrase motorized legislation. And every year you got 1,000 bills, give or take a few. And there aren't 1,000 good ideas that you should invoke and call upon the coercive power of the state. Tell people, no, don't do that. Put on a helmet. Don't smoke. Don't have this kind of fabric or this kind of construction. Well, all that's good. But if you add 1,000 laws forever, at some point you stultify the freedom and the liberty and the creativity of a society. I think of my great-grandfather, whose picture is hanging above us as we sit on this couch. And when he got here, you know, he went out there and made his life and got a stagecoach stop. And I think when they built that house, which was it wasn't a house, it was a little hotel, I doubt if he had to have an inspection. And the house that I'm building, I've had 4 inspections just for laying the cement. So there's a lot of redundancy. There's a lot of intervention. In fact, if you look over there, that's the building code over there.
In those 2 boxes?
Yeah. So
you're trying to throw one of those boxes away?
Well, no, I just like to reflect on it's one thing to say, oh, great idea, pass a law, but there's 1,000 more great ideas, but too many great ideas become a bad idea. That's what I say. A good can become a bad if you have too much of it. And that is something government has to watch, because we're embedding in a quasi-permanent system law. And law is thou shalt not. And it's interesting, if you look back, the Ten Commandments, there's only 10. They didn't every year, Moses didn't say, okay, I give you 10 now, but pretty soon we're going to give you 20. And then 30, pretty soon by this day we'd have thousands. Well, I think we need to respect the idea that law should be more abstract. It shouldn't be the first resort. And norms, and we should strengthen our society through education, through character formation, not just legislation. And that's a whole other topic, but at least you can chew on that.
Well, all that said, though, I mean, you've been fairly generous. I think you've, signed maybe 4 times as many bills as you've vetoed. Clearly, this is your final year here. I mean, what would your advice be to the next governor around this issue that you're talking about?
Well, it's usually a tactical move. You have to work with the legislature, and so you can't veto too many of their bills. And a lot of the bills are relatively harmless because they've been defanged. One of the little secrets of the state capitol is you introduce a bill with great fanfare that would do several things, but then when the opposition comes and says, okay, you better change it, then you water your bill down, but you keep the same name. And then when the bill passes, you can send out a mailing to your constituents, look what a good boy I am. I just passed this wonderful bill called, you know, the tax avoidance or the public safety or the environmental Wonder Bar Act of 2018. But there's less there than meets the eye, although there are a lot of bills that get everybody running at cross purposes.
Governor, you're in your final year. This is your 16th year as governor, divided by 2 in 2 8-year segments. If you could run again for governor, would you?
I doubt that. I don't know. These counterfactuals, I don't know. I can't tell you that. Yeah. I didn't want to run at the end of 8 years the first time, although this time I felt more creative. I think I got more things done because, in part, there was a need for more things. And also, we've been riding the wave of economic recovery, 2.5 million jobs being created by the economy, not by my office. But that allows for a lot of action, a lot of intervention and programming of one kind or another. So it's been an exciting 7 years, and I think the next year will be equally so. But whether I'd want another 4 years, I don't know. I've just produced my first batch of hand-picked organic olive oil, and it's actually pretty good. So I'm looking for other products, maybe figs or other things that I can grow, because they're already on the ranch. And I found it very rewarding that my olive oil was a mixture of trees from my great-grandfather's time and trees that were delivered from Napa from my wife's cousin. Mm-hmm. So we're merging together, and we're benefiting from the labor and creativity of generations ago. So that's interesting as compared to another 4 years of 1,000 bills a year.
Well, maybe we can check back in with you at the end of the year and see how those figs are.
All right. Governor Brown, thank you so much for taking time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Governor Jerry Brown in his office this week talking with Marisa and me. And Marisa, just a couple hours before that chat, he had been wearing a suit and tie. He was delivering the budget. He came back to the office. He was comfortable wearing a sweater and button-down shirt and drinking some tea with Honey.
Honey. He's and, got a bit of a cold.
He had a bit of a cold, yeah, but he was very generous with his time.
Yeah, I think that's one of the benefits for him, that they did restore the governor's mansion, which is just, you know, a few short blocks from the Capitol. And when I interviewed him in 2016 also, you know, he'll go home for lunch. Anne will make him lunch. He'll hang out with his, well, now one corgi. They had two dogs before Sutter
Calusa
passed away.
was there in the room, I guess. I didn't see him, but you saw Calusa.
Yeah, Calusa was under one of his assistant's desks outside before the governor got there begging for food scraps and didn't seem very plussed with us. No, but it was interesting. You know, I think you really get a sense in that interview, and particularly towards the end when he's talking about the olive oil and the figs, of a person who seems, you know, pretty content and really feels like he's done what he came to Sacramento to do.
Very content. And, you know, such a student of history, even looks at the olive oil through a sort of a historical lens, you know, with the trees from his wife's cousin merging with the trees on his grandfather's, great-grandfather's land. Just a very, very thoughtful guy, and somebody who, I think, proud of what he's done, but ready to move on, I think.
Yeah.
Let somebody else do it.
I know, and it was fascinating. I mean, this budget that he had unveiled was, you know, kind of anticlimactic. It's a lot of what we expected. It's funny, most politicians we talk to in California, the first thing we bring up is President Trump. And with Brown, you know, he's been a little circumspect about attacking him, and I think that there's a lot of other things on his mind.
Well, and we should say, I can imagine people hearing that interview and saying, well, why didn't you ask him about immigration, or why didn't you ask him about Trump or climate change? And, you know, we talked about this, you and I, before we went in to see him, and I think we decided that we didn't want it to be that kind of an interview because he speaks out on those things all the time. We really wanted to hear more of a personal story and perspective from him.
Which is something we're trying to do on this show, and I think that's important, is that we want to kind of peel back the curtain a bit and have that ability to talk to people about not just what they do, but why they do it.
And before we leave, we do want to do a little shout-out. We mentioned some of the women who are around the governor very strong. One person wasn't there. His chief of staff, Nancy McFadden, who is a friend of the show and a friend of yours, and
she
put out a tweet this week.
Yeah, she announced this week that unfortunately her ovarian cancer did return. She had to have a procedure. So best wishes to Nancy, and we expect to see her back. Apparently she's been actually at home just directing everything from there anyway.
I'm sure she will, and we hope to see her before too long. That does it for this first edition of Political Breakdown. And to make sure you don't miss an episode, go ahead and subscribe to the podcast. You can find it on iTunes.
You can also find it on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast. Our indefatigable producer is Guy Marzorati, and our engineer is Seal Muller.
I'm Scott Schaefer. You can follow me on Twitter. It's at, I almost said KQED, but that's not it. It's at Scott Schaefer, and no extra letters in Schaefer, S-H-A-F-E-R.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. You can find me on Twitter at M. Lagos.
That is a wrap for this week's Political Breakdown from KQED. We'll see you next time.